This is a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m, our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews and culture pieces from across Otepoti, Dunedin.
Good afternoon, you are listening to the Wednesday R1 News at 1. Tristan, Adam and I will be your hosts today for the last time. We've got the bulletin coming up and we've got some stories with the former R1 News producer and current RNZ producer Bonnie Harrison coming on to talk to us about journalism and student media for R1's birthday week celebrations. And then we also have our segments Conservation Conversations with Adam and Local Produce with me, joined by the Hypocriticals band. So all of that will be coming up shortly, but first I will play Pickle Darling Torn.
I thought I saw a man brought to life.
He was... Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin for Wednesday, 16th of October. I'm Tristan.
I'm Celia.
And I'm Adam. In Dunedin news, the first cruise ship passengers in Dunedin this season were greeted by protesters outside the Dunedin railway station Tuesday morning. Ruby Shaw of the ODT reports. Protesters from the Climate Liberation Aotearoa group were seen protesting the environmental impact of cruise ships, which they have labelled as giant floating hotels, where they were holding up signs with labels such as "You Cruise, We Lose." Climate Liberation spokeswoman Rosie Cruikshank stated that the group wanted to draw attention to the issue at a well-known Dunedin location that was popular with tourists, and a larger effort to see cruise ship and aviation emissions included in emission reduction plans. Protesters were also present on the streets of Port Chalmers, as well as two paddleboarders on the harbour displaying a banner as the cruise ship departed yesterday afternoon. This action was a part of a larger protest movement that has seen the cruise ship Diamond Princess being met by protesters in Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch over the past week.
In national news, Wellington City Councillors are set to hold an urgent meeting on Wednesday after the government threatened to step in, RNZ reports. Local Government Minister Simeon Brown is exploring intervention options following the council's decision to halt the sale of its 34% stake in Wellington Airport. The sale was part of the council's long-term plan, with funds intended to create an investment fund. Councillor Diane Calvert has requested a meeting with Mayor Tori Whanau and Mana Whenua to address the financial shortfall caused by the decision, estimated at $400 to $600 million. The meeting will focus on reviewing projects, seeking independent advice and restoring public trust.
In international news, Chinese military and Coast Guard personnel surrounded Taiwan's main island on Monday for a day of large-scale drills that Beijing said were a warning against separatist acts in the wake of a recent speech by Taiwan's president. The drills began before dawn and without prior notice. The People's Liberation Army said all branches of the military were approaching Taiwan by sea and air, including in a strike group led by one of China's two active aircraft carriers. The joint drills focused on sea and air combat readiness, blockading key Taiwanese ports and areas, and assaults on maritime and ground targets. Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council called Monday's drills blatant provocations that seriously undermined regional peace and stability. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs called on Beijing to pull back from the brink of a precipice, while the President's office urged Beijing to accept the goodwill offered in Taiwan's presidential speech. China's leader Xi Jinping claims Taiwan is a Chinese province and has urged it to accept what he calls peaceful reunification. But an overwhelming majority of Taiwan's people and parliament reject the prospect of Communist Party rule. In response, Beijing has escalated military exercises and incursions into Taiwan's air defense zone, as well as cognitive, technological, and economic warfare and mass disinformation campaigns. Last month, China test-launched an intercontinental ballistic missile for the first time since the 1980s. The missile landed in the South Pacific, prompting statements of concern from Pacific nations. Last week, China also participated in joint drills with Russia. On Monday, Russian state media said two militaries were continuing with anti-submarine firing exercises in the Northwest Pacific.
Russia is suspected of trying to blow up a German aircraft with a parcel bomb, The Telegraph reports. Germany narrowly avoided disaster after suspected pro-Russian saboteurs attempted to sneak a parcel bomb on board. The DHL plane had been on the tarmac at a DHL logistics center in Leipzig when the freight package caught fire. However, the flight had been delayed, meaning that the package went off whilst the plane was still grounded. Thomas Hardenwang, head of Germany's domestic intelligence services, did not explicitly name Russia as the event's perpetrator, but he states that sabotage efforts by Moscow's intelligence services have stepped up both quantitatively and qualitatively. This event comes as Russia is waging what has been described as a hybrid warfare on the West in revenge for its military support for Ukraine, which has included the attempted sabotage of US military sites in Bavaria and an arson attack on a weapons factory in Berlin.
Crown Melbourne has been fined $2 million by the Victorian State Gambling Regulator after allowing 242 people who had self-excluded themselves from gambling to place bets as reported by RNZ. The Victorian Gambling and Casino Control Commission for the VGCCC said the casino allowed the people to place bets over an 8-month period between October 2023 and May 2024. Self-exclusion is an industry-operated program where individuals may bar themselves from gambling venues to prevent themselves from placing bets. It is an offence in Victoria to allow any excluded person to enter, remain, or gamble at the casino. VGCCC Chair Fran Thorne said Crown was obligated to protect people at risk of gambling harm. As Thorne said, those who self-exclude must be able to trust that gambling providers will take all reasonable steps to enforce their decisions to avail themselves of this harm prevention initiative by allowing people to have self-excluded to enter the casino and gamble. Crown has put them at risk of experiencing further gambling harm. However, Thorne noted that a number of the 242 people who had self-exclusion were going to considerable lengths to circumvent the exclusion and place bets undetected. The fines come after the end of a 2-year probation period in March of this year, when the VGCCC declared that Crown would keep its license to run Victoria's only casino following improved behaviour. The VGCCC had previously fined the casino more than 254 various breaches.
K-pop star Hani from the globally popular group NewJeans gave an emotional testimony to the South Korean law about the darker side of the K-pop industry. As part of an inquiry into workplace harassment, Hani shared a personal experience where a manager from another idol group's agency instructed its members to ignore her, which she connected to an ongoing boardroom dispute between her producer, Min Hee-jin. Hani's testimony hinted that the bullying may have stemmed from these internal conflicts, adding that her group has faced other forms of unfair treatment, including being discredited in Japan. Despite a lack of CCTV evidence, Hani's statement has drawn attention to the stringent controls and challenges idols face in the highly competitive K-pop industry.
This has been the R1 News for Wednesday, the 16th of October. Today's bulletin was written and read to you by Adam Stightley, Celia Ward, and Tristan Serrano.
Those were the headlines for today on R1 News at 1. Catch up on previous R1 News wherever you get your podcasts or head to r1.co.nz/news.
Bonnie's work has been instrumental in exploring some of New Zealand's most important issues, helping to provide context and human stories that really bring them to life. You may know her from the Detail podcast, where she gives insights and interviews on current affairs in the past. We're really excited to have Bonnie here with us today to celebrate Radio 1's 40th birthday. So welcome, Bonnie. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, kia ora. Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. How are you?
I'm great. It's a characteristically beautiful day in Auckland. How is my beloved Dunedin?
It's honestly okay. It's a wee bit breezy. The sun is shining a little bit, so can't complain really.
Happy days.
Happy days. So you're a producer at RNZ, as I just said. What is the day in the life like as a producer at RNZ?
Well, I'm a little different because I produce the nights program, which is, as you can guess from the name, it starts a little bit late. So most days when I'm producing nights, I get into the office at 3 p.m. to start my day.
Right, yep.
And I'm leaving that building at around 11:30. So I work with a beautiful team, the nights team, really small, 3 people total for the kind of creative side. Yep. So the presenter, Emil Donovan, our executive producer, Tim Miller, and myself, and we are all Otago.
No way.
The whole Otago.
You studied here?
So, Yeah, they all did. Sadly, they don't count themselves as Radio 1 alumnus. You know? That's just my claim to fame.
We'll take you.
Well, yeah, thank you. So my day, when I get in, most of the show is already booked on a good day. The show starts at 8 p.m. and goes until 11 p.m. or midnight, really. So that first half of my day is spent prepping the interviews we're going to run later that day. So that might be writing some notes, doing a bit of research. Maybe I'll talk to the guest beforehand to make sure they all happy with what's going on, and or if they have anything they want to tell me. Or it might be finding an interview for later that day, thinking, oh golly, we've got a slot to fill.
Yeah.
So that's me getting on the blower. And on a important day, like during the Dunedin flooding, that might be talking to Jules Raddick and saying, hey, can you come on the program just after the bulletin so we can find out what's happening down where you are. So sometimes it's really important public service stuff. Other times it's really fun, talented people who are telling us about what they do, whether they be musicians or or writers or cool people around New Zealand and around the country. And then from 8 o'clock, I am in a room not dissimilar to the room you're in now, Celia. I'm in a control room at Radio New Zealand, and I am pushing buttons. I'm calling people to put them on air, putting songs on, and making sure everything sounds right. So that's a day in my life.
Cool. So really similar to this, just a way bigger scale.
Yeah.
So when you're finding people to interview, is that kind of, are you kind of just doing that every day? Like sometimes you'll interview people that you've only talked to and arranged to do it that day. Or really,
it's so daily. There are some people you can book weeks in advance because maybe they've got a book coming out or they've got a show on, and so you know, all right, 3 weeks from now we can talk to this person. But it's daily radio, so sometimes a news story is just breaking or something's just come out, so you've got to find something for that day. And ideally you'd know a few hours out, right? Okay, in 4 hours' time, I'm going to be speaking to this person. Sometimes it can be even narrower. It can be like an hour. But yeah, so it's a good mix of planned in advance and spur of the moment. What can we get?
Yeah, cool. Some people may know you from your role in the Detail podcast. That was last year, was it? And the year before?
Yeah, I was very lucky to join the wonderful Detail podcast, which is a Newsroom RNZ co-production. I started that in 2022 and I left at the end of last year. And I love that podcast. They are the most wonderful group of people, and I'm so glad it was my first proper job. I'm putting that in quotations. Of course, Radio 1 was my first proper job in media, because there was amazing mentorship on that podcast. Some really experienced, wonderful journalists, Alexia Russell, Sharon Brett Kelly, Sarah Robson, wonderful women who I learned a lot from. So it's a daily news podcast for those who don't know.
Yeah.
Big churn, small team, and wonderful people.
Yeah, cool. What, do you have any favourite episodes from working on that?
I have so many. And the tough thing about radio and with podcasts is, and I'm sure you understand this, Celia, is that once a day is done, you're kind of thinking about the next day, so it's easy to forget how much stuff you've produced. But I was a producer for The Detail. I presented just two episodes because I'm not actually so fond of being in front of the microphone.
Yeah.
I like being behind the scenes. There are a couple that stand out for me. The first time my voice was ever on a podcast, was ever on The Detail, they got me to cold call, Mayor Wayne Brown, who had just been elected as Auckland mayor, because at the time he was known for avoiding media, had just been elected and he wasn't so keen on giving interviews. And so Sharon and Alexia said to me, right, Bonnie, we'll get you to just, you know, proof in the pudding, give him a call and see if he talks to you. And so there's this recording of me, very nervous voice, saying, hello, is that Wayne? And he says, who's this? I say, oh, hi, this is Bonnie calling from the Detail podcast. How are you? And he says, I can't talk to you. And he hangs up on me.
Oh, no.
And that was that was my very first radio appearance, podcast appearance. that was really funny. And then I think my, you know, an episode that sticks with me, and again, there were hundreds that I worked on, because with producing,
it's
you're
a
working
hard question.
On, you know, five podcasts a week. Yeah, it's a hard question. But one that still sticks in my mind because I found it so interesting, and I did not expect to find it so interesting, was an episode about the future of insurance when it comes to climate events. So it was in the wake of Cyclone Gabrielle, And we talked to an insurance expert, and he was, I thought I would find this really dull. I thought I would find it really dull. And that was the fantastic thing, is I found it fascinating how in the future, you know, we insurers and councils and government, maybe they can't afford to keep bailing people out when they live in zones that are known to be climate risks,
right.
Places that are close to the sea or, you know, a variety of different places. And so much of our homes are actually going to become pretty risky and not so far off a period of time. So that actually, yeah, that stuck with me and I didn't expect it.
Yeah. That's so cool when it's something you weren't probably expecting to be so excited by.
So much.
Yeah.
So much of what I do now is new, and I think that's the best part about working with people who, you know, at Radio 1, by the time I left anyway, I really felt like a senior. I really felt like, you know, there were all these wonderful new people coming through, new volunteers, and I was feeling like I remember wearing skinny jeans into the office, and a volunteer 2-3 years below me said, "Bonnie, you can't wear skinny jeans. You know, that's so outdated." I thought, "Oh my God, I'm aging out. I'm aging out of this place." The best thing about being at the detail and with RNZ, I have so much to learn. There's so much that's outside of my experience and outside of my knowledge base that I have these wonderful people who can help me learn about these things and expose me to new kind of perspectives. And, you know, as a token Gen Zer as well, I can maybe do the same for them.
Yeah. That's what I find here. Just everyone's all got such different things that they're passionate about, but we're all kind of here for the same reason. So everyone's always just bringing in their little bits. And so everyone's just learning so much.
That's the best thing about public radio. It's the best thing about student radio, is it's a real coalescence of different people.
Yeah. So cool. How do you find the line between reporting big stories and like important stories and then the storytelling engaging aspect of things?
Like trying not to make things sensationalist, but trying to make them interesting?
Yeah, well, because same with interviews, like sometimes it might be heavy, important topics, but you're trying to keep things light and engaging and for the audience to be listening, you know?
Sure. I think it is. It's always a line to walk. Firstly, with podcasting, there's a real advantage because you get to craft what goes out.
Yeah.
You know, it's not live radio in that as soon as the words have left your mouth, you know, it's out there forever.
Yeah.
So with podcasting, you have tools like music. You have tools like, obviously, editing an interview so you can get the best bits and the clearest bits through, using clips to kind of illustrate points, being able to control pace, things like that. Mm-hmm. That's a real art form, I think. I think podcasting is great for delivering a nuanced message.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of things, live radio is so urgent, and it's great for getting out new information and unfolding information. And I think walking the line between expressing something that is serious, the subject matter should speak for itself. I think trying to make things light or palatable when maybe they're not. I don't know if I'm not an interviewer, right? I'm a producer. The interviewer doesn't need to editorialise so much because the facts just come out as they are. And I think being neutral in that case, not labouring the point or trying to kind of dress it, it will come out as it is, and often the guest and the subject matter speaks for itself and the listener will pick it up as it is.
Yeah. I get what you mean. That's good advice. Just kind of keeping things as they are and not trying to do too much extra with it.
Sometimes you don't need to do it. I think I'll return to the flooding example, right, which is maybe a good example. It was really serious. No one was dying, and no one was, at that point, we didn't think anyone was at risk of physical danger, but it was still an unfolding and really serious situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's apparent from the subject matter if you just treat it as it is. Mm-hmm. If you say these are the facts and this is what's happening, there's no need to make it sound sensationalist, because there's the truth of the matter. You don't need to hype it up, nor do you need to kind of
dumb it down. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Kind of similar to that note, as a journalist, how do you balance the demands of producing content for a national audience whilst also staying true to your own personal values?
Ooh, that's interesting. I think it harkens back to something we were talking about before, Celia, which is the best thing about public radio is you are exposed to things that are outside of your comfort zone and outside of your knowledge base. And that's the greatest thing that I've picked up from this. Because, you know, if I only, for example, as a producer, programmed things that I know and love. You know, the night's program would be filled with news about Auckland buses and trains. Yeah. We'd talk about Stonehenge every day. You know, it would be pretty repetitive, actually.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful that it's not all about me. I think I often, when we're booking something for the program and maybe something I don't know too much about, maybe it's an agricultural or a farming story, it's not my background, I think to myself, you know, is this really going to be interesting if I don't find it interesting? And almost every time I'm proven wrong, the texts come in, the emails come in, and people say, oh, I'm so glad that you talked about this. With public radio, you are delivering for, you know, 5 million different types of people, and everyone's going to find something interesting or not interesting, you know, real variation. So you can't please everyone all at once, but you certainly can spread the interest. So I'm glad it's not all about me.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that I'm trying to cater to lots of different types of New Zealanders.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. I agree. Because sometimes that's the that's kind of what we were saying before. It's the best part to like be interested about things that actually you weren't already before or just didn't know about before.
Yeah.
And kind of putting
and
your
you
own
should be challenged.
Side.
You should be, you know, you should be challenging your own perspective. Any journalist will say the same thing, which is that your own values aren't really important when you're on the job.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone has their own opinions and values and ideas about things, but as long as you're pursuing something that is true, you know, that's your guiding principle, whether it's true and fair and balanced. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think makes student radio so special or different from larger media outlets?
I imagine you've done a lot of these, Radio 1's done a lot of these interviews this week, and I imagine people will say just about the same thing, which is that it's so rough and ready, you know? And, you know, you might hear someone make a mistake, and that's fine, and that's fine. I think there's a lot to be said for student radio's dedication to and partnership with New Zealand music, alternative music, local music. That is so important, and that's historically been what separated student radio out from other outlets of its dedication there, and I think it does such a wonderful job. I was exposed to so much fantastic music through Radio 1. I was a bit of a square, I'll be honest. Maybe you can pick that up about me. When I came into Radio 1, I wasn't coming in as an alternative kid. I was coming in just as a bit of a nerd who wanted to give things a go. And I was exposed to this wonderful music that I now champion and I carry with me and I'm so grateful for. And I guess that answers my other half the question of why it's different and wonderful is weird and wonderful people come through the door and want to do radio. And they might not all be music kids, they might be nerds like me, they might just have an interest in they might just want to help out. It's such a great group of people and they all go off to do really different and interesting things.
Yeah it's so cool.
It is cool.
I'm just sitting here like yeah so cool. The final question, just because we're wrapping up for time, is do you have any advice for students looking to get into journalism or media production? And what could we be doing now to prepare for the industry?
Okay, well, I'm gonna evangelize a little bit. I'm going to get on my soapbox a little bit. It's something that was interesting to me when I was at Radio 1. People who are interested in media, in maybe an abstract way, they like the idea of writing something or interviewing people, and I think that's a good intuition. I'd ask them, right, well, what news media do you consume? And a lot of them would just say Instagram or TikTok. And that is fine. A balanced diet is essential. You should be, you know, reading stuff, the spin-off, New Zealand Herald. You should be listening to RNZ. I think, you know, people who want to write a book, they are told, right, you should be reading a lot of books. People who want to get into media, they should be consuming a lot of different media. I think that's the most important thing. Style and substance is learned. If you're exposed to a lot of different media outlets and voices, you are naturally going to emulate quality. And I think that's the issue. Exposing yourself to quality, not every Instagrammer or TikToker has the experience facilities to prepare something that's trustworthy and balanced. Whereas all the stuff you're reading on RNZ, on The Herald, on The Spin-off, on Stuff, you know, it's gone through a few processes to make sure it's quality. You know, it's grass-fed chicken. You should be looking for the grass-fed chicken when you're looking for your your media diet. So that's what I'd say. If you like media, you know, take another step and expose yourself to things you might not be familiar with, and read and listen and be curious.
Yeah.
That's what I'd say.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Bonnie. We're coming to the end of the interview now. Thank you so much for joining us. It was so nice to talk with you and meet you again properly. We will be back soon on the show with Conservation Conversations and Local Produce. But this was Bonnie Harrison, the RNZ producer on the night show. Thank you again, Bonnie, so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me, Celia.
Bye. Sorry.
Conservation Conversations, your weekly catch-up on close-to-home conservation news with Adam Stately on the R1 News at 1.
You just heard Opposite Sex by Vicarious Life on the R1 News at 1. We now welcome Fox Meyer, a political reporter for Newsroom and former editor for our friends over at Critic Te Arahi, onto the show for Conservation Conversations. Fox is a former student of Otago who completed his Bachelor's of Science with honours in Geology and Science Communications in 2021. Following this, Fox stuck around to be editor of Critic for a second year before becoming a reporter for Newsroom in Wellington. He now joins us to talk about the Fast Track Approval Bill and its potential environmental concerns. Kia ora, Fox.
Being in the press gallery with Newsroom, a lot of your recent work has been on covering the Fast Track Approval Bills. Can you give us the gist of what this bill proposes and what is the significance of reporting on the bill?
Yeah, absolutely. So this fast track bill is not the only fast track bill that's ever been passed or that we've ever used. And essentially the real thrust of it is that ministers want to be able to bundle several different resource consents into one process, which on the surface makes a lot of sense. With big projects of national significance, it is really easy for them to get bogged down in a really lengthy, difficult consenting process. And there is a problem there. However, the issues with this bill, or some of the significant bits of this bill, is that a fast track already exists. There was a Labor government era COVID fast track that projects had gone through. And I think comparing those two bills and finding the similarities and differences really highlights a lot of the concerns that people are having about this recent one. You know, why do we need a new one? What are the checks and balances that were present on the first one that aren't present on the second one? And I think you can look at a few projects that tried to go through this first one and were denied for one reason or another that are now reapplying to the second one. And if someone's making the argument, you know, if maybe a minister is making the argument saying, well, we've had a fast track before, so why is this one any different? You can counter that by saying, well, if they're so similar, how come projects that were rejected the first time around feel comfortable applying for this one? Surely there's a difference.
Yeah, I agree. And so just looking at the layout of the bill itself, do you think that this like neglects environmental protection in a way to circumvent environmental safeguards and climate considerations?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we can separate that into two questions, right? There's the environmental aspect and there's the climate aspect. And if we just focus on the environmental one first, the really critical bit to understand about this bill is the purpose statement. So the purpose statement of any bill governs essentially the number one priority that anyone will have to pay attention to when they are making decisions under this bill. So if a project comes through this process and the entry to that process is a whole thorny issue in and of itself, but once it's in, a process is given to this expert panel. And let's even assume that the people on that panel are the right people for that panel. They can only make decisions based on the purpose statement of this bill. And currently, that purpose statement does not include mention of the environment. It includes mention of significance and development and the economy. That's what they're going to have their hands tied by when they're making decisions. So even if a project does seem very destructive to the environment, it's going to be very difficult for them to use that as a legitimate reason to deny the project. Whereas if that purpose statement were changed to include mention of the environment, they could make those arguments. So even if the bill doesn't directly override environmental safeguards, which it does, it would be very difficult to actually stop something once it's before that panel for an environmental reason. As far as climate stuff is concerned, if we're looking at emissions, I mean, a lot of the projects on here will increase emissions. Some of them won't. There are a lot of wind and solar projects on here. But I think a lot of the climate-focused issues are better suited to talking about RMA reform or emissions trading scheme reform. And I know all of those are terribly exciting sounding topics, but you know, part of the real insidious nature of environmental law reform is that it's so boring and so dense that if you try to cover it or talk about it, people just stop listening because, you know, it's like alphabet soup. There's all these acronyms and meaningless phrases that just fly right over your head. And it, you know, it takes a while to get really down into it and figure out that, oh, what they're actually saying here is that they want to have this massive, you know, seabed mine that people have been resisting for 10 years. And that doesn't get communicated well if you're just talking in acronyms.
Yeah. Leading on from those being like dense and time consuming, do you think that, you know, these bills falling with like other bills with condensed time frames, such as the Crown Minerals Amendment Bill, which only gave the public a 4-day period to read and respond to its propositions, do you think that the quick time frames on these bills that are potentially climate damaging are being pushed through as quickly as possible to prevent thought out and organized opposition?
I mean, I can't say for sure if that's the definite purpose, although I would say that the urgency and haste with which this government has been producing and amending legislation is new. You know, it is new, and it's alarming in terms of a careful work process. I mean, if you're doing your uni work and you try to do the entire semester's worth of work in like 2 weeks, you're going to make some mistakes, right? Like nobody's perfect. And in all of the, you know, when you produce legislation like this, something like MB or MFE will respond with a basically an assessment of the bill. And in all of these assessments that they're getting back, the officials are saying, we didn't have time to completely consider this. So they don't even have a good idea of what the potential implications for some of these things are. So is it on purpose? I mean, it's definitely on purpose for something. Is it specifically to avoid public discussion? Maybe. I mean, it certainly seemed like that with the oil and gas, you know, the bill that you just mentioned, the Crown Minerals Act Amendment Bill. That was ridiculous. I think to put this in perspective, there's an NGO called the Environmental Defense Society. It's, you know, like them and Forest and Bird and WWF, those sort of groups. They haven't missed a public submission on a bill in like 40 years or something. And that Crown Minerals Amendment Bill was the first one that they actively chose not to even bother submitting on, because I think in their words, they said, nobody's going to be listening to this anyway. So it really, a lot of this does seem like a foregone conclusion in that space. And a lot of these reforms are being done without accurate reflection of the what seems to be the major public response to it, which is please don't do that. That being said, as fast as they're moving, it can also be undone. So theoretically, if there was a change of government in a few years, any projects that had been fast-tracked under this legislation would be, let's say, 2 years into their development and could see their consents revoked immediately. You know, so from a business perspective, if we want to look at government like a business, which it isn't, it still doesn't make a ton of sense, because there's no real security in this unless, of course, this government can promise somehow that it's going to be in office long enough to see the completion of these projects.
Mm-hmm. And again, leading on from the foregone conclusion, you said they're kind of like predetermined. Forest and Bird's acting chief executive, Richard Cabey, said that this was not a dark day, not just a dark day for the environment, but it's a dark day for New Zealand democracy. When referring to the fast track bills, do you think that these bills and their kind of structure with like the select committees and so on, do you think that like what they're doing is undemocratic in a way?
Yeah, certainly. I think so. I think the entire point of the democratic process is to allow public scrutiny and public opinion and for that to be taken seriously. And if we look at, let's take the example here of the Freshwater Amendment Bill that's been pushed through. That tackled a lot of, you know, freshwater concerns within the RMA, but then they snuck in this major change to, you know, a relatively obscure part of the RMA called Section 107 that we're not going to get into the details of, but basically the only people who wanted that changed were industry bodies. And the public was told, don't even bother submitting on that because it's not in scope. And then quietly behind closed doors, they did change that as a part of an unrelated bill. So Forrest and Byrd has now put a complaint in to the Speaker of the House about that. It's just one piece of a broader puzzle of a lack of due process. You know, Chris Bishop in the House yesterday did himself said that this is not an ideal way to do this. He said it was quick and dirty. We shouldn't be doing it this way. The Attorney General, Judith Collins, wrote to her own cabinet months ago and said, this is error prone, the way we're doing things, and we're going to need to scrutinize this process. So absolutely, it's undemocratic. I mean, personally, I feel like a lot of the policies they're trying to push through, they know are unpopular, and they know that there's going to be public backlash against. And, you know, they put up some of these consultation processes under such short timeframes because they have to have them, but they know that whatever they're going to be hearing is not really going to change their minds. That's the feeling I get. So they like to say, you know, Shane Jones has said a couple times that they have a mandate to pass this legislation and to do these things. But, you know, when you look at the share of the vote that some of these parties got, you know, it's in the single percentages. Would you really call that a mandate? I'm not sure. I don't think it's particularly democratic. I don't think it's good lawmaking, that's for sure. It's definitely bad lawmaking. But we're going to have to see the lasting impact of it, because, you know, in a field like conservation, you know, it's every single gain that you get is temporary, but every loss is permanent. And so if these bills are causing losses in the conservation sphere, those losses are going to long outlive the benefits of any sort of development that comes from this.
Yeah. Thank you. And one last question is, do you think that this is going to change the way that environmental legislation and like things like mining are going to change going forward?
That is a good question. This is something I really want to ask Chris Bishop, and I'm going to try to in the coming weeks, is this the new normal? You know, is this pace a good example to set for future governments of any party? You know, should we expect to see stuff passed under urgency like this? And should we expect these reduced timeframes for public consultation? Because, you know, if and when this government is out of power, are they going to be happy to see a different government employing the same strategy? I would guess no. You know, personally, I wouldn't either, regardless of what the bill is. If the bill was to mandate an ice rink in every single city in New Zealand, I would be stoked to see that pass through as quickly as possible, but I wouldn't consider it good lawmaking. You know, so I would be very careful to assume that anything we're seeing here is normal. And I think that the insidious part of this is because there's so much happening at once, it makes it extremely difficult to focus on any given problem. You know, if you spend a week and a half looking at fast track listings, you're going to miss three other pieces of environmental legislation that were processed overnight. So I think it's really stretching people's attention span. And regardless of the content of those bills, I think that makes for bad lawmaking and bad public process. And honestly, from a governmental point of view, it should make for a bad reputation. This is not how we should make laws. This is not how we should govern. And it's certainly not how we should make environmental policy.
Well said. Well, thank you for coming on, folks. This has been Conservation Conversations for the day. Stay locked.
This is our One Radio News. Sorry, we're out of time for today, and also out of time for local produce with the Hypocriticals. However, stay tuned for Leslie Paris's and Lily's takeover for our 40th birthday celebrations. And finally, this has been the last Wednesday Bulletin News for this year. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to R1 News at 1, here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The R1 News is uploaded daily wherever you get your podcasts. Or head to r1.co.nz/news to get yourself all caught up. Additionally, you can follow R1 News NZ to keep up to date with all our newsworthy happenings.
Thanks for listening to Radio 1 91 FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.